Good afternoon. I'm David Shelp, and in the Village Dramatist for this summer of 82, or at least this section of the summer. I am a theater graduate of Black Hills State College in Springfield, South Dakota, with my graduate studies at the University of South Dakota, their summer campus, which is the Black Hills Playhouse. And my wife, Bob, and I were there for the entire summer, which is a very concentrated summer. It's strictly theater. They do nothing but that. In my particular session today, of course, I've called From Rocks to Wagons to Broadway, picking that particular title because this is somewhat of a historical review of use of drama in religious services, and which brings us right down to, where was drama originally used? And it goes back to the very beginning of what we consider the start of drama, in other words, to the Greek period. They held yearly festivals, all honoring the god Dionysus, who was the god of wine and fertility, and their particular plays at that thing were hymns, which they called dithyrambs. And these dithyrambs were written to or about Dionysius, and he was, as I had said, the god of wine and fertility. Now, there was a reason why they would specifically point at the god Dionysius and have these big festivals. These festivals began in November and ran into April, like one after another. There was City Dionysus and all these other various names. One has to realize that the Greek city-states were not a united government. They were individual cities, each of them their own government, and they were at war with other cities, and that cost them male population. So to try to keep their own male population up, they worshipped the god Dionysius because he was wine and fertility. And it was at these kind of things that, by having these festivals, they hoped to impregnate the females and keep their male population up. So they basically were drunken orgies, and they ran very much. Now, they were religious services, and I'm not saying that type of thing is good for it, but they did come from that, and records show that they were doing these things as early as the 13th century BC. And by the 7th and 8th century, instead of individual dithyrambs, instead of one man singing a hymn, they became choral readings to the god Dionysius. And the first written record of a complete play written for him was in 534 BC, and it was written by a man by the name of Thespis. Can you tell me who Thespis was? Mm-mm. You ever heard of Thespians? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thespis was the father, or is considered the father of acting. He was known, quote unquote, as the first actor. And it was from him, and he was, one, a playwright, and two, an actor. The thing that made Thespis, that gave him a particular point at which he stood out against other actors, was that he's called the first actor because he engaged in a dialogue within the dithyramb that was not their regular way of carrying on their plays. And they feel that what happened was he was in this choral line, and it wasn't just choral reading and choral speaking, but choral movement. And being they performed in natural amphitheaters, rock theaters, which is where I get the word rock to start with, Thespis stumbled and fell, and somebody said something to him, and he responded back. And accidentally, dialogue came into the plays. Hmm. So Thespis immediately was picked up and became the first actor. And because of this, what is believed, sheer accident, the fact that he fell down, they went through that. When the Romans took over the world, and including Greece and all of the amphitheaters that they had, there were quite a few technical advances, and part of what I'm going to be covering is actual staging techniques, because I happen to be very big into staging techniques And I like to, my particular thing about being big into techniques is to be big in a very simple way. And so I'm going to go through those. But the Romans went again with, they started to build theaters where the Greeks just used the natural contour of the land. And their first theaters introduced things like curtains and moats, and they used to fill their orchestra pit with water and had ships floating on it and sea battles and that type of thing. But the Romans carried it throughout, and then until the medieval period, and the reason that it even fits into an atmosphere like Holden is, had it not been for the church during the medieval period, drama would not have survived. Because in the way things were set up with the government and the state, it was outlawed to, it was forbidden to be in a play, and at the same time, it was forbidden to see a play. It was not forbidden to write them, but they could not be performed, and you could not perform in them. So the thing then that carried drama out of the medieval period into the Elizabethan period, where it flourished so much, was the church. And being basically a Catholic church in that period, they had two different types of services. They had their mass, which was, of course, as it is much today, the distribution of the sacraments. And then they had what they called the office of the hours, which was an hourly service given, and the people of the time were expected to attend at least one of these office of the hours. And it was in there, in that particular service, repeated hourly, that drama managed to just hang on by its toenail and get carried through that and eventually flourish into something that was rather extravagant. The first written play then that went through was three lines. And those lines were a conversation, very simple conversation, between the angel and Mary. And it was the conversation at the tomb of Christ. You know, who seek ye? And we seek Jesus. You know, he's not here, he's risen, go and tell others. And it was that thing then that was the very first written record. The reason it was significant is because it was the one point in the Catholic service that it could be done in the vernacular of the country, of the people. Mass was Latin, and most of the common people did not understand it. And this was one way that the priests then attempted to make their religious services more understandable to the common person, was to some way incorporate their vernacular into it. And that meant, of course, that all of the priests were, or all of the actors at the time were priests, and they were not done in all churches, not in all of the cathedrals. They had to be large enough that they had more than one priest, because if it contained more than one or two people, it couldn't be done. And so it was the very large churches and the monasteries that carried drama on. They followed the church calendar and began being written, you know, and starting with, of course, the Advent, which begins in November, on into Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, Easter, and Ascension, just in Pentecost, as our calendar goes, the same type of thing. So when I mentioned that I'm big into staging techniques, please realize that cathedrals are built like large crosses. And had you seen pictures of some of the most, you know, some of the very beautiful cathedrals in Europe, you can't help but notice the pillars that support the roof system. They acted between these pillars, and it became the common connotation that between a pillar was called a mansion. And what they would do is hang paintings of scenery between two pillars, and then they had the area out in front of them where they would act. So it was being done between pillars. Now, if they were doing any particular story from the Bible and they needed more than one setting, they had these backdrops that were hung between the pillars, and they just walked from in front of one to in front of the next one. And if it happened to go back to the other scene, then it was back and forth, and the actors made the walk. There was nothing that actually changed within it. And that's going to be true up through the medieval period. And that was their staging technique. Well, they finally got so popular and so very good at doing it, and the people responded so well to it, that the service of the hours became kind of bogged down with these little plays. And they eventually had to be moved outside of the church. And at that time, the thinking in the government was turned around, and they had formed trade guilds that then could do services. And trade guilds basically were unions of people. So they hired actors and scene people and all that they needed. And when they moved out of the church, I mean just barely out of the church, they got just outside the doors, normally on the west porch, because typically with a cathedral, there is a very long, narrow staircase that runs along the west side of the church. And this then became their stage, so that they were above the street level. And the trade guilds grew. They each had their own priest. They each had their own patron saint. And their memberships just continued to grow. As it got further on into the period, it eventually got to a point where they moved off of the church steps and onto wagons, which is, of course, where I get that. Now, basically, there are two types of wagons used. One was a scenery wagon, and it contained something that represented scenery to give the action location. Typically, these scenery wagons contained only three mansions. Again, they kept that foothold of the church, of what was going on inside the church, out in the wagon. They had heaven, and they had earth, and they had hell. And one wagon was used to hold their scenery. Alongside of that, so that the two wagons were parked right next to each other, was just a simple flat-bedded wagon. The general acting area, again, a direct parallel of what went on within the cathedral itself. So that they kept that foothold in there, and it was very much. These wagons then were moved around town, and they were done. The shows were repeated. They were not simple things. They have records of one that hell often was represented as a large mouth. And when somebody went into hell, they went into this mouth, whether it be decorated like a dragon or anything else. They have records showing that one wagon required 15 people to run the hell's mouth. Not just the hell's mouth. That meant there were people in there that had fires going, and they had smoke, and they were all different things. The tongue in hell had to wiggle, all kinds of things. So they really got very big. And the same records show that they had hired 5 people just to paint the scenery in it, and 5 people who helped paint, and then were also actors. And on the opposite end of that same wagon, where sat heaven, they began incorporating lifts, so that if somebody was taken up into heaven, he was literally picked up and hoisted up into the air, and he would go into heaven. And consequently, they had to be designed so that they could support not only the person lifting up, but if he was carrying on a conversation with God or Elijah or somebody, both of them had to be swinging up there in the air. So they got very, very technical as far as what they were used. But basically, the three different mansions with on the wagon. And they were then pulled around within the city so that people, without actually going to the cathedral, were seeing these. At the same time they developed, so did the type of the play. They went from 3 lines to 1 play that took 40 days to do. And you can imagine the amount of people it took and that they kept going to actually get that type of show going. It also took a great deal of money to do it, which was another reason why they kept their foothold in the church. It was a good financial resource for them. But in the meantime, the opinion of the government had turned around, and these unions were hired by the church to do them. All of their material was religious in nature. The types of plays that they have are what they call mystery plays, miracle plays, morality plays, and passion plays. If I can remember all of them now. The mystery play deals with find its subject matter and jump ahead. I don't know where I went. Sorry about this, people. The mystery play dealt with scriptures. Some section of scripture. It did not have to be, you know, New Testament or Old Testament or anything else. Pulled its matter out of scripture. The miracle plays pulled their subject matter in relation to a martyr or a saint, something like that. Morality plays dealt with the trials of the common man. There are many examples that we saw, and excuse me, the passion play, of course, pulled his out of the life of Christ, the passion of Christ type of thing. Modern examples that are still around can be classified back into these four particular types. Passion play, probably the most popular one that at least is very big with young people, that you know, started 10 years ago, is Godspell, dealt with the life of Christ, and it would be an example of a passion play. You've probably all heard of, quote unquote, the passion play. You know, whether it happened to be the one that's done in the Black Hills or the one that's performed in Germany. But they deal, both of those happen to deal with the last week of Christ's life. Morality plays that deal with the common man. There is just an absolutely beautiful piece that's done at Christmas time, normally done at Christmas time. It's called The Second Shepherd's Play. And the storyline in this thing is really kind of cute. It's at the point that the angels have come and told the shepherds about the Messiah's birth and to go. But that's not the whole, that's not the overriding thing. What you see and what was developed in this play is what were the three shepherds really like. And they were partners, you know, they all had their flocks. Each one had his flock, but they combined the flocks. And they watched over each other's flocks so that it wasn't a, you know, full 24-hour day kind of job. Well, one of them was a thief, and he couldn't help himself but steal. And the only thing around that belonged to anybody else that he could steal were sheep. And he had to watch everybody's sheep anyway. But he just had to keep doing this. So he would steal a lamb from the three combined flocks, and he and his wife were both in cahoots. They would hide it in their crib and call it their new baby and all this kind of thing. And the other two would come. So it's a very cute play. You know, it really works on what kind of people they were. And then, of course, the word of the Messiah's birth is brought into it, and the change in the people, in the shepherds, come around, and until eventually they go to Bethlehem to view the baby. This play, even today, is staged on a wagon. On one side of the wagon, and they usually split it lengthwise, one side of the wagon is the home of the shepherd who has to steal everything. Toward the end of the play, the wagon is simply pulled around the stage, and there's the manger. And with Mary and the child. So it's a very, very neat play, and very commonly, not often used, because the Second Shepherd's Play dates back to the medieval period, but it's been translated and brought up where it's a very understandable and delightful piece to be done. Miracle plays, those that deal with a saint or a martyr, you know, Joan of Arc would be a good example of that type of play that's still going on. If we moved from rocks and have gotten onto wagons and now we're headed for Broadway, in other words, what's around today? Most of the drama I work with is somehow used in a church. And, you know, I do work with a community theater, but I like to do a lot of little different things in the church. And there is a great deal of material that can be used within the church service or at special periods. I'm going to hold up one little book by a gentleman by the name of Puvi, W.A. Puvi, and this happens to be his little book of dramas called Chancel Dramas for Lent. He has them for Advent and Christmas and Epiphany, and some of them are collections, so that, you know, you buy one of the little books and you get about three different church seasons to do the plays out of. Puvi bases all of his material on a particular passage of Scripture. And he notes in here what Scripture reading the play is based on. And then he develops them. I've used his work more than any other for two reasons. They're simple works. The lines are not long and hard and complicated. And there's enough action going on within the play that your audience can remain interested in it. I used them within the main body of a service, but probably more so because they are, like Lent or Advent or that kind of thing, for midweek services. And they're used directly in there. So I highly recommend Puvi's work for if you think within your own congregation you would like to pick some stuff. The reason I point out that the lines are simple and that they're not very long is when you ask somebody if they're going to be in a church play, well, gee, I don't know if I have time. Most of his works can be put together in about 5 hours. And if you can ask somebody that, well, if in the next week or 2 weeks, can you spare 5 hours? And you can get it all put together. If you're in charge of doing the play itself, yeah, you're going to spend a few more hours than that getting it done. And I'm going to address something that was hoping to be in a different session that I'm not going to do that particular session. In staging it, people have a tendency to think, well, gee, I got to have a, you know, if it calls for a living room, you got to have a sofa and you got to have a chair and a coffee table and the whole thing. When I made the comment that I'm into staging techniques in a simplified way, yeah, I'm into it big, because people's minds will create everything that you need. If you give them the suggestion, their subconscious brings out what you need. An example, and I'll throw my plug in for Charlie Brown tomorrow night. Come, they're talking about this tree here. It's very little. And we all immediately know what a little tree looks like. I didn't need to draw a picture of a tree or to paint a tree, you know, or build one or anything else. We all know what a little tree looks like, and that's true. And that's not true just for us as adults. That's true for little kids. Their minds are as active as ours, and if you give them a suggestion, it will come through. So I don't like to, you know, clog things up with scene pieces or anything else. Plus the fact you're doing them in a church, and whether your altar can be moved or if it's permanent, you know, you have these things that you have to work around. And it's an obstacle to work around. But if you approach it not as an obstacle to work around, but approach it as something that within the house is permanently there, maybe it's your communion rail. But you can address that as being a room divider, a border along, you know, a stairwell, something like that. And then you can just, you know, the audience will accept that. And the big thing that you look at is simplicity. Keep it simple, they'll accept it. And The thing that you're working for in any play at all is believability. It's the one thing that you want to try to get together. When you get into technical directing and whatnot, they start talking about motivation. And everything on stage has to be motivated. Well, the bottom line of whether something is motivated or not is it believable? Do we actually believe that that could be a living room? You know, a sofa and a chair. Can a sofa, a chair, and a coffee table be believable as far as being inside of somebody's living room? And yes, it can be, very easily. And it's the way it's used. You know, if your actors sit on that chair and sofa and whatnot in the same way that you would sit on it, then your audience will accept that, and they'll go with simplicity. One of the later sessions that I'm supposed to have is, you know, no budget up against the stage wall. And I'll talk a little bit more in depth on that particular type of thing. But Poovy is one man that has a great deal of things out. Now, normally when you select a play, you pay royalties. There is some cost for doing a show, and they vary. Usually the first night, the cost is higher than any other time. What he does is if you buy the book and use it as a script, you have paid the royalty. So you don't have any extra additional costs that you're looking at. That's one of the main reasons that I like to use him. Because if they get around to it, you can turn around and say, hey, look, you know, the books are a couple of dollars each. And you can continually use them. And it doesn't matter whether you do one this year and one the next year, as long as you've bought the book, this man is satisfied that he's being paid for his efforts. And so they're very good things that way. The forms of drama used in the modern church, of course, are very, very wide. There are operas that are constantly being used. You know, the most recent is Jesus Christ Superstar, which is a full-fledged opera. It's a rock opera. You know, I'm not going to deny that. It's a beautiful piece. If you ever had an opportunity either to sit and listen to it or to pick up the little book that's often included with the record, and just read it. It's really a very nice piece. It gives you some insight into some of the characters. And that particular one, to me, Judas Iscariot, is really well defined. It gave me a different look at Judas. Not in the fact that, when we call somebody a Judas, we have a negative feeling about him. And in Jesus Christ Superstar, Judas is not portrayed as a negative person. He was, after all, one of the selected. And Christ did pick him, and he did follow, and he did believe in Jesus. But he finally grew to a point where things were moving too fast for him, and he wanted to slow it down. And there's a beautiful, absolutely beautiful character development of Judas in that opera, and it's a full opera. Now, as whether a person can take on trying to do an opera, of course, that depends on what kind of help you can get. I'm not that musical, so I would have to farm out a whole lot of chores kind of thing, but that's kind of to you. And of course, musicals themselves, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, which one I, Godspell, which when people see it, they really come away moved by it. It's a simple show. Can be beautifully done and really come out nicely. The one thing that people have a tendency to neglect in the church and in religious services anymore is comedy. And I feel that's very unfortunate because God gave us a sense of humor. And there are whole books of plays, exactly like what Poovy puts out, that are strictly comedy. A man by the name of Dahl, D-A-H-L, has a book out that's called Clowns for Christ. And it's often confused with actual clowns because there are puppet groups that deal with religious material. There are also clown troops that do.
But this is a book of comedies that all deal with religious material, and they look at our situation from a comic side, not just the tragedy. You know, our trials and tribulations are not all heavy. Some of them are rather comic, and you know, we can probably share those things with us. So they, you realize that there is one play that is that I like very well, and I would recommend it to a person. It's called "What Are We Going to Do with These Rotten Fish?" It's based right out of the point when Christ puts the finger on James and John, and you know, tells them, "Go out, cast your nets." And they haven't had any luck all day, and the boat fills up. And when he gets them back to shore, he pulls those two people away, and their partners are stuck there with a boatload of fish. So many fish, they're almost sunk. So they're in the dilemma, what are we going to do with all these rotten fish? And it's not only rotten, but rotting fish. And it's a very, very interesting piece, because it plays right at that point. We know the story as it's related to us, and then it goes on. And there's a man and his wife who are following Christ. They're always trying to catch up with him, and all these little things happen. Really a very cute piece. And I think when people avoid comedy in a church service, as a play, it can be used the same way. Because God gave us a sense of humor, and it's a very nice thing to have around. Now, the other thing that I want to particularly address is children in play. There's an old adage in theater that says, you don't use animals and children. That's not true. We've all seen Christmas programs, and you know, they've always had the cute little kids that will wave and that kind of thing. You know, I've directed those, and you try to keep them down. That's the problem. That's why they say don't use kids, because you can't do that. They're going to wave, and if you accept that fact, it's not going to get you upset. Little kids are going to do it. They see mommy and daddy, they're going to stand there and wave. You know, you probably did it when you were a child. I probably did it when I was a child. And my mom and dad probably thought, oh boy, just like everybody else. I don't feel threatened by using children at all. And so they're very good. But the other thing I wanted to say about children is, if you have an opportunity to do a program for children, there's a few things that one wants to keep in mind. Drama is set in action, a conflict and in action. And we know that the attention span of little kids is not real long. They can't follow complicated storylines or situations. So very briefly, the thing that one likes to do is keep the action moving, keep it going. And if don't let it lull down. Now, I'm not saying that there can't be some point in a play that the action line, if it's running up, has to come down. It's got to come down, or your whole production is going to become stagnant. And that's bad. But if it drops off to emphasize a point, whether it be the point emphasized at the bottom of the drop, or you drop it off so that you can emphasize the next climb, or if you dropped it just because you have made a very important point and now you want to use it as a contrasting figure. You know, it can be used in any of those three different ways. Action will always go up and down, and you can vary it with tempo and the whole thing. So it's keeping that in mind when you're looking at working a show for little kids. Keep the action going. The other thing that I recommend to anybody, and it doesn't matter that I tell whether it's a teenage cast or an adult cast or anything else, your eye will follow action. Any movement on stage will draw attention to it. And if we know that and realize that, then we can put movement on stage so that it does draw attention. And that's just another way to help keep things going.
and you can make little kids watch, and they love to watch action. And that's the one thing that dealing with little kids is real important in, you know, so that they can sit down and enjoy it so much more. Do you have any questions for me? I've been talking for nearly half hour.
I just want to tell you that in the tape I heard on David Teedy, he's doing it on the miracles in Luke, and the miracle of the fish is one of the miracles, and he brings up that play as
does he?
You know, something that you could use
as
part of his talk.
It's fun. It's called "What Are We Going to Do with All These Rotten Fish?" Rotten fish. That one, it does. It starts out. It's the language is written kind of rough, because it just doesn't call them. You know, just it's not just these damn fish. It's what are we going to do with all these goddamn fish? And when I run into something like that, change it. If you don't like the language, change it. An author is not a piece of rock that you can't chisel away at. If you don't like what he's done, change it. Make it fit your situation. Because if you're not comfortable with it, neither are the people who are going to see the show. And I would never do that show using the language the author's written down, because it's too harsh. Because I think they say the same thing. You know, whether I use a couple extra adjectives to describe it, or whether I just say, what am I going to do with these rotten fish? You can get the exact same feeling of disgust over the whole thing without swearing if you just pump your actor and get it with his voice. You know, he'll know what the line is written there. He'll have it right in front of him. But you tell him, we're not going to say that. And you know, that's one thing. There are always little stage directions given within a play, you know, like he crosses over to the table or something like that. Authors, when they're playwrights, only put down very small limited suggestions. And if you keep and work only on those suggestions, then you're going to find you have a very boring show. You know, I made the comment, drama is based in action. And if you let everybody, if he enters stage right, she enters stage left, and they stand and talk to each other across the stage, everybody, little kids and on up, are going to lose their attention. But if they're interacting, if they're moving while they're up there, it's going to be a lot more interesting. So I don't think a playwright around ever expects everything he has put down is going to be used, or that action is not going to be added to it. Because if it's going to be good and accepted, it's going to move. It's going to keep moving. So, but, you know, that's just referring back to your comment. I'd change those lines. If you don't like them, change them. And you have that liberty as a director to do it.
We have a group in the Olympia area, Seattle, Tacoma Olympia area, called Taproot. I go around to the different churches and do plays, and they're becoming having a good reputation, so more people are going to their plays, and they're all Christian-based plays that they do, and they just use a ladder and a stool and very few props.
Yeah.
A ladder for upstairs, downstairs, or a giant and a small person.
We're one of the groups that have the real short, maybe 40 seconds up to 4 or 5 minute type things, or are
no,
they all based?
No, they usually do two plays, a 10-minute play and a 20-minute one, about a half-hour thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very good.
I don't remember where they were based out of, but there was a troupe of Christian players that toured, and I think they were called Christ Players. And they were based here on the West Coast. This was when I was back in the Midwest. And they had like 13 different groups out touring, and what it was 6 people in the van and everything that they needed to go around. And of course they did the same thing. They had a repertoire of between 80 and 100 different plays, and you couldn't carry scenery for that kind of thing, and you did it in a van. They used a van because then everybody was at least comfortable in where they sat, and they traveled all over the country. And they, like I said, they had over 13 groups that 13 of these vans cruising around that did plays, and they went to churches and they went to schools.
And they range from like, you know, 40 seconds to 10, 12 minutes. Their pre-advanced notice was a kind of sheet that listed the plays they had, but also told the subject matter. If you wanted to talk with drugs, they had a list of maybe 10 or 12 plays that they did about drugs, or running away from home, or any of the problems that are so often encountered, you know, with young people. And they weren't always just Adam. They run a 30-second play or 2-minute play. And then they open it up to the audience right away. And this is something that's really, really good, because the audience gets into it. They get to talk about it. And I can remember one, I don't remember the title of it, but the whole gist in the thing was this young teenage girl was going to run away from, no, a young teenage girl had been caught shoplifting. And her mother was in the bathroom, you know, getting ready for this, what, and she was reprimanding her daughter because of sin, telling her how horrible it was. The police brought her home and she was so embarrassed, and stealing, she just couldn't understand that, you know. They brought her up as a good Christian and they just don't see where she went wrong and what did they do. And Mama walks on stage drying her hair, and as she pulls the towel away from the hair, it says Holiday Inn on it. That was the end of the play. And that opened up conversation right away. And, you know, obviously the first question, where'd you get the towel? Kind of thing. And they're a real good, they were a good group for that kind of thing. Anything else I can address to anybody? Or try to answer?
If you've not done plays in your congregation, mm-hmm. and you've not directed them before yourself, should you just get a book like that, the one you mentioned, and just try?
Yeah, that's the simplest thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
If you really want to get into it, mm-hmm. okay, really get into it, the book that I consider, okay, my black Bible of directing, of play direction, is called Play Direction by Dietrich. And it's a very good thing, but it gets down into the nitty gritty.
Mm-hmm.
And done some total, it's a long process. You know, properly doing a play requires that the director read it at least 5 times before he actually starts. First time he just reads it to find out what the story is. And then the second time he's looking for character development.
Mm-hmm.
The third time you're reading, you're looking at it for what is it going to require for staging. And you read it for line interpretation. And sum total, you read the play 5 different times before you sit down to work with it.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular book called Play Direction really gets down to the nitty gritty. Then you also chop it up. A good example is plays are divided into motivational units. In other words, everything has some motive. Action is motive, is motivated. Dialogue is motivated. And they're divided into emotional and physical and situation, different types of units. And when you start, it's very helpful to sit down and map out those motivational units. Anytime somebody else comes onto a scene, you've changed the physical motivation of the people that were already there. Because there's brand new motivating factors. The very presence, the fact that physically somebody else walked into the scene,
mm-hmm.
has made the other 2 people change. They may carry on the dialogue, but suddenly they're aware that there's somebody else there, so that they, psychologically, the characters change just by the fact someone's there. And this book really gets into it. But Puvi's plays are you know, nice and simple. And the big thing you find is, well, yeah, I don't know if I want to spend that much time. Well, there's not a lot of time involved into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not when you really get down to it. If a director does about 2 or 3 hours of homework prior to it, and basically that's blocking. You know, in other words, you're going to enter over here, and I want you to cross over here and move over here. And then I want you to move to them, and I, you know, pick up the pitcher of water at this point, or lay your sign down, or something like that. That's the kind of homework I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good way to
to get them started. Yeah, you can pick up a little book and do it. And you, the more you do, the easier it comes. To me, blocking, and maybe it's because I no longer sit down and break a play into motivational units. You know, through experience, I can see the motivational units now. In other words, I know when things have changed within each character to see that they're there. So blocking is where I spend most of my time. And it takes days and days for me to block a show, because I will block it. And then when I get, what I find is, at the end of this scene, I have these people standing over here. Or at the beginning of the next scene or the next act, if they're still on stage, I have to remember that they're back here. Or you may find out, you may have spent, you know, 3 or 4 pages of script and you've done a beautiful job blocking and everything is just perfect, and suddenly they're on the wrong side of the stage because they were supposed to be over by the coffee table and you had them over by the sofa, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to go back and you move around. A director is nothing but an artist. Just like some artists paint canvas. Well, a director does exactly the same thing. He paints pictures. His medium is different, that's all.
Okay, then what is a producer's main thing then?
A producer?
If you have someone that's producing a play and someone that's directing, the director is the one that's taking the play and putting it on the stage.
Okay. You're asking the split between them.
Yeah.
Okay.
What does a producer do?
Okay. I don't mean to oversimplify, and this isn't him, but he's a big gopher.
Okay.
Go for this, go for that. Very important. He used to be a one-time producer. All he did was finance it.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, when you invest a whole bunch of money into a show,
you also want to be involved in
you
it.
Betcha.
Okay,
it's
so
going to be done your way.
So it's not like the manager of a baseball team, it's more like the owner of a baseball team, if you wanted to.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. You hire your coach,
mm-hmm.
or the manager. You hire the manager of that baseball team. Well, the owner of that team is going to say, hey, I want you to try to draft this guy, or let's mm-hmm. trade and get somebody else. And he's there constantly putting input. And he does a great deal of work, too, right, with the director. At the same time the director is saying, doing this, producers, because it's a very big thing. They have a great deal of the same duties that a director does. And their pictures change. They're no longer just the money people. They were at one point, but now, motion picture-wise, maybe the studios finance the pictures. So the producer is a man hired by that studio to make sure that the director just doesn't go off hog wild and spend $90 million rather than the $3 million that they do, kind of thing. So they're very, very close to what they do. And they have to both agree on what's trying to be done in any one scene. Because if they don't, time is money to them when they're working on that kind of thing. Usually a director in a church play doesn't have to worry about that. But when you get into Broadway and that kind of thing, you do. They're expensive, It's they start $10,000 before they ever hire an actor. It's already been spent. And that's just getting the rights to produce, and they'll hire their director, and then they start going through. Because at the same time, they'll have to rewrite scenes. They know they change them constantly. And if you've ever heard the old thing, we bombed in New Haven. Well, that was the testing ground for Broadway. And if you didn't make it in New Haven, it wasn't going to make it on Broadway. And of course, a lot of people bombed New Haven. kind of thing. I hope that answered it.
Have you ever met with resistance in churches to accept drama?
Yeah. Yeah, Godspell. Church was pretty conservative, had some real conservative fathers in it. And we were really very careful the way we approached it. It was as a youth project. As a matter of fact, the first time I ever came to Holden Village was I brought my cast
from Godspell up here to rehearse. And it took them away from the tensions within the church. It also took them away from their own involvements. But yes, you run into it, and it can be real funny. And you just have to decide, is what they're saying more important than what I want to try to do? And you eventually, you're forced into that personal decision. And you have to be ready to do it. To give an example, if I can continue this story, we had those within the church that did not want Godspell done. They didn't get real verbal on why. They didn't think it, you could do something else, something small. Don't need to do that. And so when they came to see the production, they had a negative feeling. I mean, there wasn't going to be a good show. I mean, they had already made up their mind.
They came anyway.
Oh, yeah, they came because they were there. Mm-hmm. They were going to make sure that nothing like that ever happened again in this church. Mm-hmm. And, I think we all know what Godspell is like. It's a very, very moving piece. And I redid the end of Godspell. Typically, as is tradition, one, it's done on a chain link fence. They hang them on a chain link fence. Mm-hmm. Well, I had no budget. I borrowed all of my scenery. I borrowed a stage to do it. Now, the only thing the church had for it, and I even borrowed the paint, from a small community theater. No way I could get chain link fence. And I couldn't put something up as a permanent structure, and you'd really need something solid to hook your fence to. So it was a rectangular stage. It had flats across the back with two very small flats coming forward, and it was painted like a circus wagon, wagons that you keep your animals in, the tiger's cage or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that was our set for it. The only other set pieces were two regular sawhorses that I happen to have in my workshop at home, and two pieces of plank. And two very, very small little sawhorses that I built, and that was the scenery for the whole show. We did not, when I said rewrote the end, we did not take Christ off the cross. We left him on. And it ended up that the overall appeal was just that much more heightened. Mm-hmm. Because, we eventually took him off, but not at the point within the play that the author had taken him off. We went through the whole lamenting. He dies. And usually they get up and they start to remove him. We stood up and left. And everybody just very slowly. Now, one thing that I like to do, because I think it heightens the effect of any play, is to work down in the audience. I like my actors to be in the audience, to say lines from the audience. And Godspell's that kind of show. They're talking about problems. Mm-hmm. We had them giving out flowers. Turn Back, Old Man, which is kind of a tempting song, parallels the 40-day temptation. Mm-hmm. We put the gal down with a microphone in the audience. And like one thing she did, we happened to have a pastor who wore a toupee. She walked over and sat in his lap, rubbed the top of his head, and said, "Can that be real?" Got him walked off. And I like to work them down in the audience. Okay, so they then got up, went down through the audience. Judas was the last person getting up to leave the stage. And as he got down about the second step, as the lights very slowly came down with kind of a concentrated light on the cross, he turned around, looked back at the cross, turned back to the audience, and it was a guy with a beautiful voice, very talented teenager. He hit right on the note and started, "Prepare ye," which is the way Godspell starts. Mm-hmm. "Prepare ye the way of the Lord," not the way it ends. Mm-hmm. So we went back and used the same tune to end it that we used to start it. The rest of the cast had just kind of circled the audience, and then they picked up "Prepare Ye the Way." Mm-hmm. And so by the time Judas was down on the floor, they were all back in it. He had gotten through the audience. The intensity of the music had grown
all using prepare ye the way of the Lord, which was exactly what it started with. Then they went back and took him off the cross. Mm-hmm.